Into a Parliament Monday, 25th of March, 2019. Before we proceed with this morning's parliamentary business, I want to make a ruling. Members would recall that I have, for some time now, been encouraging you to use the mechanism of a neutral motion. The Chief Minister, on the 14th of March, 2019, gave notice that he intended to table a motion requesting that this House, quote, note the tax treaty between Gibraltar and Spain entered into on the 4th of March and signed by the Right Honourable David Livingston MP, the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, on behalf of Gibraltar, given the United Kingdom's responsibility for Gibraltar's external relations, end quote. The next day, the 20th of March 2019, the Honourable Roy Clinton gave notice that he intended to amend the Chief Minister's motion. It is my considered view that the motion tabled by the Chief Minister is quite in neutral terms. The standing orders of this House do not provide for neutral motions. Accordingly, Standing Order 55 applies, and this states, 1. In cases of doubt, the standing orders of the Parliament shall be interpreted in the light of the relevant practice of the House of Commons of Parliament of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And 2. In a matter for which these standing orders do not provide, the said practice shall be followed and that no restrictions which the House of Commons has introduced by standing order shall be deemed to extend to the Parliament or its members until the Parliament has provided a standing order for such prescription. In the case of the House of Commons, good 2013 of the House of Commons standing orders, public business 2018 provides, and I have consulted a copy of these which I have with me, and provides, where in the opinion of the Speaker or the Chair, a motion that this House, or, as the case may be, the committee has considered the matter, is expressed in neutral terms, no amendments to it may be tabled. This is corroborated by Erskine and May in its 24th edition at page 409, which states, quote, no amendments may be tabled to a motion that the House has considered the matter expressed in neutral terms, pursuant to Standing Order number 24B. I then instructed the clerk to seek guidance from the clerk of the House of Commons and closing a copy of the Chief Minister's motion together with the Honourable Mr. Clinton's proposed amendment. And after receiving their advice, it is my ruling that where the motion is expressed in neutral terms, no amendment to it may be tabled. Therefore, in the light of the above ruling, I have concluded that the Honourable Mr. Clinton's amendment would undermine the neutrality of the Chief Minister's motion and are therefore not admissible. Could that not mean that the Honourable Member cannot rehearse his argument during the course of the debate on the motion, or indeed table a substantive motion in due course? Is after the holding of the speaker for any member to stand on the matter and speak on the matter? No, I'm sorry, but that is the procedure here and elsewhere. But that is the practice in the matter of Parliament, and I follow that practice. And I have previously rehearsed that situation. So I go already been occasions when I've made a ruling, and I am sorry, but honorable members cannot speak on that ruling. What they are able to do, if they wish, for instance, to challenge the ruling, is to bring a substantive motion to do so. That is the practice of Parliament. I take 1 point of order. That you can make a point of order arising from a speaking from arising from the speaker from the speaker's ruling. It's an out of benefit, let's say. Okay? So an out of benefit, let's say. I'm not going to say anything about what you just said. Sorry, but I am following the world made by practice here in Gibraltar, which I myself have previously ruled, and in the House of Commons. When the Speaker makes a ruling, then when the Speaker makes a ruling, that is the end of the matter. That is the opinion and the ruling of the Speaker. And the only way that the rules provide for the matter to be taken up is by means of a substantive motion, where the Honourable Member may cross the paper. First and second reading. A very first to raising a perfect sentence to be imposed, including in respect of any person, entities, groups, organizations, states, and territories for the purpose of the security of Gibraltar, or of national peace and security, or in any other circumstances where it would be appropriate to do so, and for implementing in Gibraltar any restrictive measures imposed outside Gibraltar. The Honourable Deputy Minister. Just for the record to say that both this bill and the next one I have received certification from the Chief Minister that they are referenced. Speaking of the policy move of the bill for that to make provision enabling appropriate sanctions to be imposed, including in respect of any person. Entities, groups, organizations, states, and territories for the purposes of the security of Gibraltar, international peace and security, or in any other circumstances where it would be appropriate to do so, and for implementing in Gibraltar any restrictive measures imposed outside Gibraltar, and for collective purposes to be read at the first time. Now, put a question, which is that a bill for an act to make provision enabling appropriate sanctions to be imposed. Including in respect of any persons, entities, groups, organizations, states, and territories for the purposes of the security of Gibraltar, or international peace and security, or in any other circumstances where it would be appropriate to do so, and for implementing in Gibraltar any restrictive measures imposed outside Gibraltar, and for connected purposes, be read a first time. Those in favor, those against, carried. The intentions. 2019.
Because the move that the bill for the Sanctions Act 2019 be read a second time. The Speaker, this bill provides for immunity to implement both international and domestic sanctions in Gibraltar. These sanctions include financial sanctions, immigration sanctions, trade sanctions, aircraft sanctions, and shipping sanctions. The bill creates two separate regimes. The first, contained in Part 2, provides for the automatic recognition of enforcement of international sanctions regimes in Gibraltar without any further implementing legislation. This includes restrictive measures imposed by the UN Security Council, by the European Union, the designation of President of the UK, and under terrorism legislation. The second regime in Part 3 is for domestic sanctions that may be imposed by regulations for a number of different purposes. Including the prevention of terrorism, the financing of terrorism, the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, etc. In particular, there are a number of amendments to the bill which I will be proposing at committee today. These amendments are both the result of an audit of the bill taking into account proposals of national obligations, and also feedback from stakeholders received after the bill was published. It needs to be outside of honourable members of the time, noted that those amendments now since the 7th of March when I. The Speaker, Part 1 of the bill comprises clauses 1 to 5 and includes the general introductory and interpretive provisions. The international sanctions regime comprises clauses 6 to 14 proposed by the United Nations is in the for the United Kingdom. The international sanctions will not require implementing legislation of the border, and will have immediate effect as soon as they are made. This budget and in particular Clause 6 are aimed at satisfying the financial sanctions task force requirements for international sanctions to have almost immediate effect. Because of Clause 7, the two amendments which I will be proposing in the committee today, they are both future-proofing amendments to set out that any restrictive measures imposed by the United Kingdom under the Sanctions Countermeasure Order Act 2018 will have effect as in relation to any restrictive measures that have been imposed by both the United Kingdom and the European Union, or restrictive measures imposed by the UK Treasury, respectively. These amendments are to ensure that moving forward, should also the United Kingdom's sanctions regimes in relation to international sanctions are fully aligned. Clause 7 is the enabling provision that affords legal effect in proposals such as the national sanctions. Mr. Speaker, from this stage, I will be proposing an amendment to this clause following comments that have been received on the draft. The amendment is there to ensure that any modifications necessary to adopt international instruments to our law maintain the minimum standards of those international instruments. Clause 8 provides for judicial notification of the list of our producers and holders and obligation of persons undertaking relevant financial services business to have procedures and policies in place which ensure that they are aware of the list of persons to whom sanctions apply and that they undertake the appropriate steps in respect of such sanctions when undertaking relevant business, in fact, relevant financial business, not just financial services business. There is also an amendment to the clause which includes the United Kingdom's personal statement. Clause 9 creates an attempt to breach of international sanctions, whereas clauses 10 and 11 provide for licenses to be issued where these are permitted under the terms of international sanctions, and also creates the attempt to breach the terms of the license. Clauses 12 to 38 set out procedures for the board to make requests of the United Nations or other bodies for particular list of individual instruments to be made. We are proposing amendments to clauses 12, 13, and 14 again as a result of comments that have been received in the draft. These amendments set out on the face of the legislation the objective standard of proof that is required for such a designation or proposal, and that the designation of proposal is not reliant on there being a criminal proceeding instituted, and also what needs to accompany such a proposal and the manner in which proposals are to be made. The amendments also set out the manner in which such requests are sent to the appropriate body. Part 3 deals with domestic sanctions. The main power for imposing sanctions is contained in Clause 15. This is a regulation-making power which may be used in two different instances. The first is where the purpose of the sanctions falls within such a two of that list. The second is where the purpose is compliant with an international obligation. Although Part 2 provides for the direct recognition of international sanctions, the powers in 15.2b is included so that there is the opportunity to respond to any international sanctions by specific legislation, so that might be considered appropriate, particularly if the nature of international sanctions is difficult to control, otherwise in the greater context. Also, there is an in-built facility which is future-proofing, in case it is considered appropriate to impose sanctions as a result of obligations that may arise outside of the UN-EU context. The list of purposes for which sanctions may be made is largely those available on the mandate to Her Majesty's Government under the United Kingdom's Sanctions and Anti-Money Laundering Act. These include the prevention of terrorism, the financing of terrorism, the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, the interest of security, providing accountability with respect to human rights, etc. The figure of an amendment to Clause 15.1, which has been made to reflect the government's special responsibilities under the Constitution with respect to external affairs and internal security, as well as clarifying the standard that needs to be met for such regulations to be made. Clause 15 to 16 being built upon Clause 15 includes setting out procedures and steps to be followed for the request for a designation from outside Gibraltar. Speaker, I will be proposing an amendment to Clause 16b and a new Clause 16c, which respectively set out the evidentiary standard of proof to be applied in making a determination in respect of the request received from outside Gibraltar in the making of such request from Gibraltar. Clauses 17 to 21 set out the types of sanctions that can be made, and these are financial sanctions, immigration sanctions, trade sanctions, aircraft sanctions, and shipping sanctions. Clause 22, as read with Clause 15.5f, allows for domestic sanctions to be imposed as a result of any international obligations where these are required because the international sanctions cannot be complied with. Separately, which is new for me, also invokes the power of the EU's international obligation to better implement the foreign force by regulation. Article 26.6 of provisions that allow for personal use and ships to be designated, and calls for the 7 provides for exceptions and licenses. These exceptions can be made in the regulations made under Regulation 15, for example, to make provisions for reasonable living and legal costs to be made. In addition, regulations may provide for the issue of licenses so that it is an appropriate avenue to provide particular exceptions. Clause 28 is an information gathering power that may be included in regulations made under Clause 15. This is aimed at allowing for relevant information to be obtained and also to make information gathering through records or registers an obligation in relevant circumstances. Clause 29 provides for the enforcement powers that may be included in regulations under Clause 15. And Clause 30 allows for the extraterritorial application of regulations that conduct affairs in Gibraltar or outside Gibraltar by a Gibraltarian or Gibraltar resident. Clause 31 to 36 applies to persons who have been designated and to ships that have been specified under the review procedures that are required in the circumstances of the Constitution on human rights and those who have been subjected to sanctions. Clause 37 to 39 provides for the review mechanisms for the regulations that are made under Clause 15. Part 4 of the bill contains provisions allowing for a review by the court of a number of decisions made under the bill, including decisions regarding the use of designation. And Part 5 contains several provisions, including the general penalty for the commission of an offence under the bill. Speaker, the House will just stay with us for a moment before I commend the bill to you. I'm conscious that in the preparation of this bill, and because we have to consult so widely, and honourable members will have seen, and I have referred to the fact that there are numbers which are 16, capital A, etc. So the bill has had sections inserted to it once the format of it has been agreed. Mr. Speaker, I intend to ask the leader of the House that the document should, before final publication, renumber the bill, so the numbers appropriately from section 1 through to its final section without having to have the capital A section inserted to it, which has, if something has arisen in the course of the preparation of this bill, this bill, Mr. Speaker, is essentially required also because as a result of leaving the European Union, they're leaving that section, which is where we need to make provision for it. But it will be future groups and will be well received in the context of the international compliance by the bill, in particular of the Financial Action Task Force's own approach to sanctions. And just anecdotally, because it's always the time, honourable members should know that one of the things that the Chief Minister was at the Dagger Yachter almost every morning is signed a legal notice in respect of sanctions which are being applied to individuals around the world. And since the invasion of part of Ukraine, people know things that is constant, and all the members of the team in the Gazette, and since the European Union is imposing sanctions in different countries in Ukraine, in different aspects in the Ukraine, and the European Union has named even those military officers who were in charge of vessels at the time of that conflict. And so there is a constant stream of people that are being subjected to sanctions. Our current regime requires that the incumbent of the office of the minister sign off all of these things every morning. And so this is a more effective way of dealing with that requirement, which I therefore entirely endorse and I commend the bill as a whole to the House. Before I put the question, is any honourable member wish to speak on to land principles and members of the room? The honourable leader of the Speaker, I'm grateful to the Chief Minister for comprehensively addressing his amendments to the bill as notified to the Parliament and going through a number of clauses in respect of this important bill. This bill will have a full support of the Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for that indication from honourable gentlemen for. Not just on the agenda, for all members of the official opposition. I don't know what position the radio will take, but I'm sure it will be supported from the indication that we've given. And therefore, Speaker, I would suggest that when we're dealing with the amendments in the committee, honourable members have the letter. If possible, we take the bill as including those amendments
put the question, which is, that a bill for an act will make for this an amazing appropriate sanctions to be imposed, including in respect of any person, entities, group, organization, state, and territory, for the purposes of the security of the voter, for international peace and security, or in any other circumstances where it would be appropriate to do so, and for implementing Gibraltar any restrictive measures imposed outside Gibraltar and for connected purposes, be read a second time. Those in favor? Those against? Carried. The Sanctions Act 2019.
The committee statement said we will be taken today if all other members agree.
Do all the members agree with the committee statement said we will be taken today? A bill for an act to amend the Tobacco Act 1997. The Honourable the Chief Minister.
I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to amend the Tobacco Act 1997 and for connected purposes be read a first time.
I'll put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Tobacco Act 1997 and for connected purposes be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Tobacco Amendment Act 2019.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to move that the bill be now read a second time. Mr. Speaker, this bill amends the Tobacco Act 1997 by the insertion of a new section 4A for minimum retail prices of tobacco and a new section 6.4C. Mr. Speaker, the bill arises from the need to amend the Tobacco Act in order to create a legislative framework for tobacco to give effect to the new regime for the retail pricing of tobacco in our market. This is set out in part in the Memorandum of Understanding of Tobacco under the withdrawal agreement. All honourable members will know that the only view on tobacco follows the position that the government has been putting to this House for all of the period since we have been elected. We have put up the price of tobacco by over 148% since we were elected. I've repeatedly said that the price of tobacco is only moving in one direction. It is on an escalator. And have, in effect, demonstrated that in budget after budget. As a result, we've also been voting the best in favour of our law enforcement agencies by adding layers of controls and powers to those that are available when dealing with the illicit trade of tobacco. We are now in a position always going to ensure that our legitimate trade of tobacco is not affected by the untruths told about it in the international press, usually but exclusively at the citizens of Spain. So, in creating a new regulation to give the collector of customers the power to restrict the price of this tobacco from the sold at retail, what we are doing is protecting our legitimate industry market in tobacco retail, whilst at the same time continuing our agenda of raising the price of tobacco to these two things. The first is to reduce the price differential to Spain from those that would encourage an illicit market. The second is to continue to make tobacco a less attractive commodity for those who are hooked on it. The reason for this is driven by pure public health integration. Mr. Speaker, no one in the world now thinks that tobacco is anything other than bad for the health of those who smoke. In that sense, it is also bad for governments that provide universal health care for all, as it causes myriad different health problems. That is why I consistently said to the House that the price of tobacco is in that constant escalator that I referred to earlier. This bill creates a separate and potentially sharper escalator for retail tobacco prices. The provisions of the MOU that are relevant, Mr. Speaker, on tobacco are those set out in Article 1 of it, which provides as follows. The government of Gibraltar, being concerned about the health consequences of smoking and the existence of an illicit trade in tobacco in the area around Gibraltar, alongside the legitimate market in said commodity, has committed to ensure that by the 30th of June 2020, the average retail price differential of tobacco products, cigarettes, cigars, fine cut tobacco, and other tobacco products, will be no more than 32% greater than the most recently published Spanish prices for the equivalent tobacco products in mainland Spain and the Balearics. The commitment for retail price differential will not apply to duty-free sales of tobacco products to passengers in ports and airports. For cigarette products, the market will be divided into four categories of products: premium cigarettes, mid-high cigarettes, mid-low cigarettes, and a lower pricing rate, with a minimum price provided for each category. For fine cut tobacco, the market will be divided into three categories of products, premium and non-premium, with a minimum price provided for each category. The Gibraltarian Competent Authority will set minimum retail prices for each of the categories of tobacco products, which will be published quarterly in the Gibraltar Gazette. The necessary mechanism will be put in place to ensure effective compliance by all retailers with the minimum prices provided for the law. This is what the bill will enable, Mr. Speaker. Not required. This is an important distinction. This is a bill for an enabling act, not a prescriptive act. Section 4A of the bill is a section that allows but does not require that electric companies to publish on a quarterly basis by noting that they have minimum retail prices of tobacco. This is therefore an enabling task. The collective companies, however, may only publish in situations when they have proceeded to divide types of tobacco sold in Gibraltar into different categories. If the collective companies categorize the such tobacco, a requirement to publish arises. It must be highlighted that the minimum retail price of tobacco as published by noted by the collective companies do not apply to duty-free premises within the departure and arrival ports of the Gibraltar International Airport, the cruise liner terminal, and the ferry terminal, or any other duty-free premises designated by order by the collective companies. As it stands, Section 4 currently contains conditions pertaining to the issue of a retail license. The inclusion of a new subparagraph C within this section now additionally requires holders of retail licenses to adhere to the minimum retail prices published by the collective customs in the notice of publishing the Gazette from time to time. Failure to meet the constitutes a breach of the retail license and will be dealt with in accordance with the provisions of the Tobacco Act 1997. Lastly, Mr. Speaker, can you state that the ruling and amendment to clause 4 of the bill to substitute the reference to the Tobacco Act 1997 with this act? Mr. Speaker, this is just to make a better and more appropriate reference dramatically to the act, but it is the Tobacco Act 1997 that is being referred to. But as it is in the act itself that the reference is contained, it is more appropriate from the drafting point of view to refer to this act. This clause is to be in place to cover existing retail licenses issued before the commencement of the Act in order to make them comply to the provisions contained therein, namely adherence to the minimum retail price of tobacco published by notice by the collector of customs. Mr. Speaker, regulating the retail price of tobacco in Gibraltar, whether agreed with others or otherwise, is a good thing. It is an important part of better regulating our market in this country. That is what this bill before the House does, and I therefore commend the bill to the House.
Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the challenge of the bill? The honourable leader of the opposition.
Mr. Speaker, whilst we agree with the Chief Minister's comments in relation to tobacco smoking being bad for the health of our community, we wholeheartedly accept that. Insofar as what the Chief Minister says in relation to the changes made to the law to increase the powers available to our law enforcement agencies to tackle the illicit activity in tobacco, we again support those measures that the Chief Minister speaks about today. Mr. Speaker, we would also, in relation to the control of tobacco pricing, have a social measure, Mr. Speaker, in principle. This is something, of course, that will enjoy support from many of us on this side of the House. But, Mr. Speaker, we have been clear, as in the Memorandum of Understanding on tobacco. We have said that the Memorandum of Understanding are bad for Gibraltar, and therefore we will be voting against this bill, Speaker. There is nothing, Speaker, in our view, that secures enduring benefit for our community. This bill provides Spain having a say in our affairs, and it protects frontier workers' benefits. Speaker, we have, on numerous occasions, raised serious concerns about the government's lack of strategic direction and inconsistency in respect of Brexit. We believe it was wrong, Mr. Speaker, for the Chief Minister of the day to align himself with the Prime Minister. It was wrong for the Chief Minister not to pursue a differentiated position for the people of this community. And it was wrong for the Chief Minister to give away the biggest bargain to on frontier workers without obtaining nothing permanent and enduring for Gibraltar. We have said, Mr. Speaker, on many occasions that the Memorandum of Understanding is invaluable to advance the interests of this community. The Memorandum of Understanding is excellent. Allows encroachment into our domestic affairs by Spain in in relation to matters concerning our water, the environment, fishing, and tobacco. The tobacco bill, therefore, was speaker on the face of it, is tied inexplicably to the memorandum of understanding, and we believe that the memorandum of understanding is not in our community's wider interest, and we will not support it, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, the Tobacco Act brings about some material changes affecting retailers in Gibraltar. But in the first instance, on behalf of the many tobacco retailers in Gibraltar who have made representations to me, I have to ask the question, why is government in such a hurry to pass this bill now, and can this be better explained to the tobacco retailers in Gibraltar? As far as we know, if Mrs. Miller's deal were to go through, the EU would still give the UK time to pass the relevant legislation. So the rush to pass this bill through is still unclear. Further, what is the sense in passing this bill without the existence of the withdrawal agreement, as government should be tackled according to their policies that should not interfere with market forces by setting selling prices? Furthermore, Mr. Speaker, in clause 481, it says, the collector of customs may divide types of tobacco sold in Gibraltar in different categories, Mr. Speaker. So I have to ask, will this apply to all brands, premium brands, cheap brands, English brands? In clause 482, it also says that the collector of customs will publish minimum retail prices in the Gazette. Once the prices are set up by the collector of customs, how will they know if the retailers are really selling at minimum prices, and will customs do the patrolling to make sure that these prices are abided by? Many retailers are very confused, Mr. Speaker, so better explanation of the mechanisms of this would be very much appreciated. Also, Mr. Speaker, the bill allows wholesalers to sell tobacco at the same prices as previously, while retailers cannot, given that they will have a minimum selling price. Does this reality not have the propensity to skew the market as the trade could shift to the wholesalers directly? In addition, Mr. Speaker, in clause 483, it says minimum retail prices published by the collector of customs in subsection 2 shall not apply to duty-free premises within the departure and arrival rules at the Gibraltar International Airport, cruise liner terminal, and ferry terminal, or any other duty-free premises designated by the collector of customs by order of the Gazette. Mr. Speaker, I do not know whether the Chief Minister is aware of this, but food passengers are actually buying tobacco on their way into town on disembarkation from the ship, walking into town with the duty-free prices, and actually turning them for a profit because they can, Mr. Speaker. And I can vouch for this, as I have seen it with my very own eyes. So, Mr. Speaker, this is causing unfair competition at the very minimum, taking into account that they then go through town and see the shops in town advertising higher prices than the ones in the terminal. The tourists then rebuy the tobacco and they raise back into the ship. So how a trade is supposed to compete fairly, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, for reasons of principle, conscience, and intended public health and environmental implications and the like, I would like to be able to support this bill, but would just appreciate some clarification for what I have stated above in light of what I see as some contradictions and inconsistencies and pitfalls in this piece of legislation. Thank you.
Is there any other amendment to speak on the second reading of the bill? I'll ask the member to Mr. Speaker again. I'm grateful for the honourable leader of the opposition indicating that his party supported all of the principles underlying the bringing of the bill. I was therefore a little surprised to see where he went with the rest of his speech. If somebody considers that what a piece of legislation does is the right thing to do for the right reason, how can that person vote against the legislation in question? Because it arises also in the context of an agreement done internationally. Well, the speaker, there are any reasons not to agree to these things because Spain might think that they are a good thing. But there are also many things on which we all agree in the Western world, even, dare I say, with Spain. So the speaker was in part the Tourism Act,
gentlemen must agree that there are agreements at international level between governments, including the government of the United Kingdom and the government of Spain, in respect of the control of terrorism. So let's begin. This is not because there is somewhere in between an agreement between the United Kingdom and Spain, to which the voter is also agreeable, a good reason to vote against a bill before the House. Of course it isn't, this is because. But I don't remember simply want to make the point that they are against this because it is connected to the mechanism that we have strategically pursued under the requirement that we are going to leave the European Union. So, I think it is the first time in this House that somebody gets up and says this is the right thing to do, but we won't do it because we have agreed this with Spain. I read to the House that part of the Memorandum of Understanding that deals with the requirement to back the agreement as to prices. It isn't a requirement. There is not a woman that goes to the MOU. There isn't a requirement on the voter. There is a reflection of what the voter is going to do. There is a reflection of what the voter is going to do. I've already read that article into the Hansard. But that is not to give anybody a say in our affairs. I am stretching the imagination. Now, I think that the bigger honourable members are pursuing the principle that if you repeat something which is manifestly untrue often enough, it might persuade some people that that is the truth. They can pursue that politics again if they wish to. They did it, Mr. Speaker, in the context of the LNG facility that we are now about to see finally committed and operating. They've done it, Mr. Speaker, in myriad other instances. It just doesn't stick, because if there's one thing that is true, it's because that the electorate is always cleverer than the politician. And the electorate sees through any attempt to obfuscate or to the things that politicians may come up with. So the fair thing to do is just to tell our community all of the facts and let them decide for themselves. There is no say in our affairs to say. So if the honourable members have not worked out, since they lost their corporate memory in the face of all those who were, almost all those who were in government with the party positions in which they carried, clearly all of the decision makers in the government of the party positions in which they carried, of how the price of tobacco is set in Gibraltar. It is absolutely straightforward and normal that if you have a territory that is with a land border to another territory, one of the developments of the commodities that are subject to arbitrage is by looking at the price in the other territory. I will tell them something for nothing in case they didn't know. Every time I dealt with the price of tobacco, the successive budget by myself with the price of tobacco, cutting the price of tobacco up by 148% since I was elected. I did it by looking at the price of tobacco in Spain. Or is it that they haven't worked that out? Because it's the way that they used to do it as well. The rule of thumb has been to look at when price goes up there, so the price goes up here. But price, of course, in Gibraltar, because we have a different currency, is also subject to the difficulty of the changes in the value of the currency. And that is the way to figure that successive governments of Gibraltar have fixed the price of tobacco. Who is anybody a say in our affairs, Mr. Speaker? Or is it that other contiguous countries that have similar agreements are giving say in their affairs,
Everything else that I thought the MOU, I will give them this piece of advice. And they never follow my advice, so I'll be very pleased if they continue doing what they are doing today. Don't forget that the aspects of the negotiation that the Deputy Commissioner, the Attorney General, the Financial Secretary, and the Human Capital Guard run has been to manage to get control, sovereignty, or jurisdiction, or civil over the affairs of things. Because it would be the greatest political negotiating victory since Robert the Bruce, Mr. Speaker. It is remarkable, Mr. Speaker, that the Honourable Gentleman is saying that we have been saying a certain amount of in respect of areas of reciprocal compromise. So, just as I spelled out here, when we go through the estate, everyone knows what the estate is. There's all the black, there's all these other estates that you sometimes use it at election time. So, we want to make an argument which might somehow enable them to pretend that the Jesuits are the hard guys on sovereignty, and the Jesuits are the soft guys, rather than liberals, the soft guys on issues of sovereignty. He should not make the argument that we have achieved the greatest negotiating coup in the history of negotiation. Because it won't persuade anyone. Why am I giving him this advice? I mean, because I'm giving residual effect for him, because what he's doing is making my argument easier. We have not given faith any say in our affairs whatsoever, Mr. Speaker. But we suggest it. At the same time that he logically must therefore be conceding if he maintains that position, that we have given them a say in our affairs, and therefore we have got a say in their affairs, runs completely contrary to the suggestion that we have no strategic direction. So if you think that he is saying that we have, by mistake, accident and error, obtained a say in the affairs of Spain. Or is it that he doesn't think so? The things that we say. Well, logic. There could be nothing more dangerous, Mr. Speaker, than somebody holding themselves out to run this nation who don't think through the principles that they set out in the speeches that they give and the consequences, the natural, logical consequences of what they have said. And that perhaps even more dangerous. Because we do have strategic direction. Strategic direction that has been explained in so far as is possible, whilst not deluding ourselves of strategic advantage to the whole community, and to them, in private, Mr. Speaker. And sometimes I'm struck by the fact that honourable members say, you know, the government is not saying enough. When we meet them and we get them a briefing and they go on television, they say, well, look, I know it's so long, but I can't say more. Because it wouldn't be in the interest of all. Well, Mr. Speaker, that in itself demonstrates that there must be some strategic direction that they appreciate in what we tell them because they agree that they shouldn't then go and say more about it. Not because I wouldn't want to bring into my confidence the 32,000 people that you work with, but because, of course, there are others who are machinating to damage us and we have to ensure that we don't. So there was a lot of strategic direction. And if honourable members bother to look at the logical consequences of the things that they say and have said, they will realise that they accept that there is strategic direction. But Mr. Speaker, that it is not the government policy to have found a differentiated solution to Gibraltar. Of course, it is also contrary to the facts and to what the honourable gentleman is saying. So you see, Mr. Speaker, one of the reasons that they object to the MOU is because they differentiate us from the rest of the United Kingdom in terms of trade agreement. So, Mr. Speaker, therefore we have differentiated Portugal. But the first time that somebody used the terminology, a differentiated solution for Gibraltar, it was on my lips, not theirs. And I was wrongly criticized by them. For suggesting that there has to be a differentiated solution, Mr. Speaker. Well, not a differentiated solution, not a differentiation as we might like, because we would have liked to have stayed in the European Union, finding a mechanism that might have allowed those nations of the United Kingdom and Gibraltar to have stayed in the European Union, whilst those nations of the United Kingdom that had voted to leave might have left. It would have been the premise of differentiation. We were not able to achieve it. It's obvious. Neither of those have been able to achieve it. Or if you say, if anything is saying, Mr. Speaker, that we haven't been the chief minister of Gibraltar, we have just persuaded Theresa May, Boris Johnson, then the Foreign Secretary, now Jeremy Hunt, and everybody else, to have given Gibraltar a differentiated
communism, even if not as differentiated as you might have wanted. In fact, in any event, what other members do not seem to appreciate in the criticism that they constantly put is that they are orienting a child of growth in the United Kingdom who are criticizing the material agreement as if it were the permanent for looking for post-EU life. It's not. This is the mechanism for leaving the European Union. This is not a future relationship between the United Kingdom and the EU. This is the mechanism for leaving with a managed exit. So the differentiated future relationship with the European Union is something else. For which honourable members of this are obviously bitterly divided, as bitterly divided as they are, on whether we should be leaving the European Union or not. Because our members of the honourable members of the party of the executive are saying we should leave without a deal. And the honourable government is taking his head. You should just look at the triple face of some of the members of the executive. I'm sorry, it's not the executive. It's the executive and somebody else is not in this room. Other members of the executive and the CEO of the right? They're saying we can leave without a deal. But the revenue that comes to them, we can leave immediately without a deal. Others, rightly, are granting for a certain agreement. Because we agree that we should remain in the European Union. We're going to referendum remaining. That's three hours. For the speaker, with that, I agree. Thinking, you know, but this is all wrong. But when it comes to the future relationship that we're dealing with now, when it comes to the future relationship, they're definitely divided. Because the one who isn't here, I don't mean the one who is never here. Because it's not a member of here. I mean the one who isn't here because he's away in the demonstration, has said that in the future we should have exactly the same relationship as the United Kingdom has. And in some occasions he said,
what does
the shining light of logic that I am replying to. Think with what happened if Gibraltar has pretended to use central workers as a bargaining chip. What do you think would have happened to us if we would have been included in the Spanish provisions and law for no deal? But we think that we would have been included in the withdrawal agreement. So we think that that's the way to drive a hard bargain. Because we think that that's the way to hold the moral high ground in international relations, to hold people hostage. Is that how the Honourable Gentleman thinks that we should be running our affairs? Because although you might think it might make a good headline, that may still make him seem like a tough guy. His toughness would have lasted a moment. His argument would have been turned into us. He would have lost the support of every ambassador in Brussels and of every head of government in Brussels. He would have made Gibraltar's argument absolutely impossible to defend if he had polluted our position in that way. That is the most dangerous approach that we could have taken. I really do think that if this is in our affairs, of course we can have disagreements about the MOUs and the detail of them. Of course we can have disagreements. And all of our members are told a very good way to find those areas of disagreement and rightly highlight them and point them out. That is their role, and what to do with an honourable member who has done that now in the context of the Honourable Lady's intervention in respect to this case. But to go through, to plumb the depth of how to negotiate with the idea that we explicitly, as a strategic objective, set out to you the most vulnerable workers as a bargaining chip. That this man would not be in the casino of politics. Because that's obviously how he thinks it. He sees this as a casino. And I'm not ready to use people as bargaining chips, and I'm not ready to take risks with our nation, which is what he would have done if he had to do that alleged strategy. Much better the strategic objective we have pursued to ensure that the vote is protected in every eventuality, that our people, of course, come first, but that also we ensure that those who come to the vote to add to our wealth and continue to do so. I'm not surprised, however, that the Honourable Gentleman took this attitude to working, because when he was asked for a recent television program whether he committed himself to the standards, to the labour standards of the EU after we have left the EU, all he said was that we were very impressed by the document produced by United on apprentices. He did not give that commitment. A commitment which this government has given before the referendum, during the referendum campaign, and after the referendum. The speaker turning to a much more edifying, although equally disagreeable in some respects, contribution from the Honourable Lady, which I'll put out to her where I disagree with her. I don't believe that it is right to say that tobacco retailers are all in one mind thinking that this is a bad thing, Mr. Speaker. I have met many tobacco retailers, and I have met all the tobacco wholesalers. Why have I met all of one and only some of the others? For a simple reason. The Honourable Lady will know that there is not a handful, but I think 12 or 20 wholesalers, and there are over a couple of hundred retailers. And therefore, it is easier to meet one lot and not the other. But a lot of the retail activity is in retail outlets owned by wholesalers also. The tobacco retailers that I met and the wholesalers that I met fully understand what the implications of this bill are. But in case some honourable members don't understand it, I'll make it a little clearer. Today, the differentiated price between some premium brands of tobacco between Gibraltar and Spain is in the region of between 25% and 28%. So, in other words, we are closer in price to Spain
5% difference of spend. I think it's still biased. Some of the cheaper brands may not be within that price differential and will be in the future. So, what we have detected, and this is our own law enforcement policy, is that we have some limited activity, a lot less than we have in the past, still ongoing, because some retailers are selling in excess of the requirement of their licenses in the number of transactions that they do with some people. Not all. The majority, of course, the vast majority of tobacco retailers comply with the requirements of their licenses and comply with the law. So it's become clear to us that the problem area in tobacco is in the retailing of tobacco in some particular respect, in some particular brand. So, dealing with the issue that the Honourable Lady raised, I will start first with the issue as to mechanism. Why is there a need to do this bill, even if there isn't a majority? Well, I don't know whether the Honourable Lady is clairvoyant and knows what is going to happen. But if she is, please share with me and perhaps even with the Prime Minister an insight into what is going to happen. But nobody knows whether there will be a withdrawal agreement later on today, or middle of this week, or next week, or not at all. In fact, I would say that for the first time, it would be very interesting to think that there is a possibility, and I don't think that has been before, that we might remain in the European Union. Nothing could make it happier than all my work in the past 3 years should be out for nothing in respect of withdrawing that we should remain. But it is also possible that there could be a withdrawal agreement, and that withdrawal agreement could be in place even during the course of this week. That is why I sought to emphasize to honourable members, and I presented to them, that the changes to the legislation are enabling and not prescriptive. In other words, this creates a regime that may be pursued by the collective customer. It may be pursued when the time comes, or it may be pursued even if the time doesn't come. Because I'm quite happy to say to her, in the context of answering another one of her questions, if I'd like to interpose her answer, that in fact, controlling the retail price of tobacco is very common in many jurisdictions. It is another lever that law enforcement uses in order to ensure that there is control of the tobacco market. So we are not exclusive in going into the market and controlling the price of the retailing of tobacco. It happens in many jurisdictions around the world. So my own view, my own policy position, is that this is a particularly helpful way of dealing with the tobacco market that we would want to pursue, even in a humane way. Because it gives us additional helpful levers to control that market. But the thing in any event, if there is a withdrawal agreement, it could be visited upon us within hours or days. Frankly, it looks like there may not be a withdrawal agreement. If you look at the mathematics in Parliament decision. But honourable members will know that with Brexit, things are no longer moving day by day, they're moving hour by hour. We can go to bed one night being told that things are going in the direction of members of that group known as the European Research Group and the Democratic Unionist Party being more likely to support the Prime Minister. We can wake up to changes and say that that's not going to happen, and then to a ruling by the Speaker of the House of Commons to suggest that the dynamics, the political dynamics in London are moving in a different direction. So I think, again, if normally you would bear with me, this is about being prepared and about being ready. That's why I emphasize the fact that it produces lengthy changes that are enabling and not prescriptive. But the job today, I'm conscious of the fact that as we met at 11 o'clock, the Prime Minister is holding a special cabinet meeting in London at 10 o'clock United Kingdom time. Members of the cabinet have been brought into Downing Street to look at documents in camera before they had the debate on those documents in cabinet. Might be bitten by that bug, Mr. Speaker, and the own members of my cabinet with just an hour to look at something that I put before them an hour later. I mean, I think it is absolutely remarkable. I didn't say we would ever get away with it. To deal with colleagues in that particular way, but look, that's not the policy today. The reason I'm saying that is because at 12, the Prime Minister has a meeting with the European Commission. So at 4:30, there is a further statement to the House of Commons the unlikely of group. And that is what we're driving the mechanism that we're putting before the House today to ensure that we collect the House power in the event that there is a requirement to comply with all of these provisions. I don't think the question is why we should or should not interfere with the pricing of this particular commodity by those things are happening in many other jurisdictions. And the craft of the tobacco, I took a few in my speech, I'm quite happy to share those with her later as well as the wishes. The craft of the tobacco are the mid-high, mid-low, premium, and cheaper, although we don't use the word cheaper, and we try to avoid using that terminology. The other point is that retailers are confused by the amount of growth. As put it together the way this is what a piece of legislation which enables the collector to do something. And we are very clear that because this is something that affects not just retailers, but also retail purchasers, the mechanism that will emerge from this enabling legislation, which I've already seen, is a very clear direct that sets out prices very clearly so that purchasers can go to the web, which is now available online, and see the prices. So it's very easy and very transparent in that sense. The other thing is that the wholesalers could take profit, or could take the market, he said. Well, it's not possible for wholesalers to take this market because wholesalers cannot sell retail, in particular in this commodity. So, under our system of regulated sales, in particular in this commodity, in order to be able to sell at retail, now to sell a carbon or a profit, you have to have the retail license and sell through a retail establishment. It's not possible for the wholesalers to do that. They would not be able to do that. But in any event, if a wholesaler sold a retail, or made a retail sale, it would be subject to the requirements set out in this legislation, because otherwise there would be a breach of the legislation. So therefore, it is not possible for wholesalers to take the retail market. But it's also, in my view, clear that there will be profit here. And so, it will be a question of negotiation between retailers and wholesalers as to who takes what elements of the profit. The government may also be moving in respect of its ability to raise duties against the tobacco, whilst the prices are moving also, but that will be a different policy decision to be made. I don't recognize the Honourable Lady's suggestion that food passengers are buying tobacco and disembarkation and then coming into town to send them for a profit. I don't see anybody who buys tobacco in the future then selling that tobacco in our city. And any example of that, none of the law enforcement agencies have brought back to my attention. So it is true that there is a shop at the food line terminal that sells tobacco, the prices are lower than in town. And if you see that people can buy from that shop, if they have access to the food line terminal as food passengers, both on the way in and on the way out. But I haven't heard that anybody that goes on a cruise in order to come to Gibraltar and sell the tobacco in town, which wouldn't make any financial sense for them. Okay? I have been discussing with the Chamber of Commerce about that particular shop, Mr. Speaker. That shop, the opening of which arises from the closure by the former administration on the ferry terminal and the litigation which was started against the government as a result. To see what controls we can put there. Honourable Lady should know that the terms of operation of that shop are the same as the terms of operation of the shops at the duty-free terminals in the airport. But of course, there isn't the easier access to get out of the airport that there is from the cruise line terminal, where passengers come in and out of the terminal because they're able to be able to want them to come into Gibraltar. So the government's already trying to deal with the issue of a rhythm which the Chamber of Commerce has put forth in relation to that job. That is, in my view, completely unaffected by this change. But there may be things that we need to do in respect of how that job sells and whether the Navy sells to people on the way into the vessel rather than also on the way out of the vessel and into the building. It's something to frame up on the government's agenda. Mr. Speaker, there is absolutely nothing in this bill that gives things in our affairs, that deals with any of the mischief that the Honourable Gentleman says incorrectly that was created by the enemy. This is a freestanding piece of legislation which creates a path for the collector of customs. The collector of customs will want to use it in the way that I have set out, dealing with the issues that are set out in the MOU, but this bill doesn't do that. This bill does the thing I called out, all of it, the Honourable Minister of the Defence said will do this. So I therefore commend the bill to that. I now put the question that a bill for an act to amend the Tobacco Act 1997 and for the House of Deputies to be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. How is the Honourable Lady voting? She isn't. Then we are stolen. And we're pretending to the contrary. Very well. There are nine government ministers who have voted in favour, five members of the official opposition against, the Honourable Lady has abstained, so the second reading of the bill is carried.
one part of the bill. That is 1 to 5. Second part of the bill. The long title. Second part of the bill. A bill for it to amend the Tobacco Act 1997. Clauses 1 to 2. Second part of the bill. Clause 4 is amended. Or clause 3 is the amendment itself is executed on the Tobacco Act 1997 by the Act. Second part of the bill. Long title. Second part of the bill.
That the sanctions for 2019 and the tobacco amendment for 2019 have been considered in committee with you two with amendments, and I now move that they be read a third time and passed. I will now put the question, which is that the Sanctions Act 2019 and the Tobacco Act and the Tobacco Amendment Act 2019 be read a third time and carried. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? You're voting against the third reading? Of the Tobacco Act. That is the a member absent. I don't know who wants to know. Two members absent. The four members of the opposition present here, the Honourable Edwin Radius, and the opposition vote to intend, and the Honourable Chairman, are voting against the third reading of the Tobacco Act. Other than that, I now move that we be heard a third time and carried. First and second reading. I now move that the House is adjourned to Friday the 6th of April at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And Mr. Speaker, I think I share the views of the whole House, and because we are a whole community, and I think that I hope that by then we will all have greater clarity as to what it is in the United Kingdom Parliament is likely to take in respect of withdrawal from the European Union and or not from Brexit.
The House will then adjourn to Friday the 6th of April at